From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, portraits from the refugee camps. We talk with Fazel Sheikh about his work photographing refugees from Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia, and Rwanda. Sheikh says he wanted to capture what he saw, survivors, not victims. There's a traveling exhibition of his work at the International Center for Photography and a companion book. Also, how to treat the obsessive-compulsive canine. We talk with Dr. Nicholas Dodman, an expert on animal behavior at Tufts University. He has a new book about how to treat dogs with behavior problems. And rock historian Ed Ward on Austin, Texas's music scene, which has been up and coming for quite some time. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has signed a sanctions bill against Cuba. The White House ceremony came on the same day that Republicans go to primary polls in Florida, home state to many Cuban Americans. Mr. Clinton's support of the bill could help him with voters who traditionally have gone Republican. The sanctions bill passed in response to Cuba's downing of two U.S. civilian planes last month. Four Cuban Americans were killed. The bill gives Cuban exiles the right to sue investors from other countries in U.S. courts if the investors benefit from property taken during the rule of President Fidel Castro. More than half of GM's 29 assembly plants have now shut down because of a strike at two factories in Dayton, Ohio. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
More than 55,000 workers are off the assembly lines at GM plants from Canada to Louisiana. The reason? 3,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union have been on strike at two Dayton plants since last Tuesday. The Dayton factories make the brakes for virtually all GM cars and trucks, and one by one, the assembly plants have been running out of brakes to install. The latest workers to be laid off by GM are in Oklahoma City and in Arlington, Texas. A company spokesman says 16 assembly plants are down and 13 remain open, but those 13 cannot stay open for long. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Former Interior Secretary James Watt has been sentenced to 5 years of probation and fined $5,000 for his role in an influence peddling scandal. NPR's Gene Cochran has more.
Watt had faced a possible jail term of up to 6 months, but even prosecutors refused to recommend he get any prison time. The former Reagan administration cabinet member pleaded guilty last January to a single misdemeanor charge, admitting he tried to improperly influence a federal grand jury investigating his lobbying activities. Because prosecutors were eager to close the books on the case, Watt was able to wipe out 18 felony charges by pleading guilty to the single misdemeanor count. Watt's indictment followed a 5-year investigation into corruption at the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Reagan administration. The probe yielded 16 convictions and more than $2 million in fines. HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce was never charged. I'm Jean Cochran in Washington.
Former Ohio Congressman Donald Buzz Lukens returned to federal court today. He's being retried on charges of bribery and conspiracy. He was found not guilty of 3 bribery charges last year, but jurors deadlocked on other counts. The new jury will try to decide if Lukens used his office to enrich himself by taking money from a chain of failing trade schools. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down just 6 points at 5,574. Trading is extremely heavy. This is NPR. 7 states are voting in primary elections today. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole is predicted to gather up most of the presidential delegates now up for grabs. His remaining rivals are dismissing increased GOP pressure to quit the race. Publisher Steve Forbes told a group in Chicago that he believes it is still important to get issues before the voters. Commentator Patrick Buchanan still wants a role in designing the GOP platform at the national convention this summer. Neither man will drop out or endorse Dole. The Super Tuesday states are also holding Democratic primaries, but President Clinton does not face any serious opposition. The Social Security Administration, in a rare case, has awarded survivor benefits to a Louisiana girl conceived through artificial insemination after her father's death. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
In what's believed to be only the second time that survivor benefits have been granted to a child conceived artificially after the father's death, Social Security officials agreed to pay 4-year-old Judith Hart $700 a month. The agreement averts a federal court battle with the girl's mother, Nancy Hart. At first, the Social Security Administration fought Hart's claim, citing a Louisiana law that a child conceived after the father's death is not recognized as his heir. But now officials say the case raises significant policy issues that were not contemplated when the Social Security Act was passed. The decision will apply only to Judith's case until policy catches up with science. This is Debbie Elliott reporting.
The human rights group Amnesty International reports Chinese citizens aren't safe from human rights abuse. The group's latest review finds widespread use of torture, unfair imprisonment, and political repression. Amnesty says China's economic reforms have not led to more liberal human rights policies. The organization says brutal forms of torture are commonly used in prisons to extract confessions or as punishment. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, in for Terry Gross. The pictures we've come to associate with the plight of African refugees are those heartrending photographs of hungry, sick, emaciated children near death. They are often the impetus for action for sending food and medicine to those in desperate need. For the past couple of years, my guest, photographer Fazel Sheikh, has visited refugee camps in Africa where Ethiopians, Sudanese, Somalis, and Rwandans have fled civil war and famine. But his photographs give a different picture of refugee life. They are portraits of individuals, of families, friends, and groups of people who, while living in desperate conditions, have managed to create a community. Fazel Sheikh grew up in New York and in Kenya. His photographs are currently on exhibit at the International Center for Photography in New York and are in a new book called A Sense of Common Ground. Fazel Sheikh first went to a Sudanese refugee camp in 1992 on a United Nations High Commission for Refugees flight, along with aid workers, some journalists, and another photographer. Instead of rushing in to take his pictures, he hung back, watching and waiting. After the team got what they wanted, they left, and Sheikh stayed behind with his camera. Before he began to work, he says he thought it was important to find the camp elders and ask their permission to take pictures.
It just seemed to me that though I had the UN permission, if I wanted to move into a community, I certainly had to ask the people that, in a sense, were running the place. And so, yeah, I decided after a time to approach the elders, a man named Deng Dao, and I was given a meeting with him, and I asked him for his permission. And he had noticed me moving through the camp in the previous days. And he said to me, I'm just a refugee. Why are you asking me? But I tell you this, the tone of his voice was such that it was clear that he had seen it as a real trespass that people had moved in and just moved through his community without his permission. And so I think just by virtue of asking, it gave me a kind of entree to another sort of side of the community there. And he agreed, and we began working together, and he began really to instruct me about what the other levels of the community held. And in another sense, by giving over the power to him or to the refugees, in a way makes it impossible for you to choose a person based on their physical type. You know, you can't move into a large group of people and say, oh, you know, that person looks really funky. Let's photograph that one. And I just sort of let them decide. And by virtue of that, I witnessed things that I never could have imagined would be so strong or striking.
You speak Swahili.
Mm-hmm.
Does that give you a special entree in some of these camps anyway?
To some communities it does, but it's... Sometimes it sort of sets me apart because they're curious. Why, you know, why is this person who looks this way speak our language? The fact that I have somewhat a common history does often give me an entree. And sometimes in the Somali border, my name, you know, oh, Sheikh Fazel Ilahi, it's okay, you know, suddenly. So it was mixed, I think. The good thing is that it allowed me to communicate generally, you know, directly with the people in most of the camps.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about how then you took these photographs. Looking through the book, they clearly
look like portraits. You clearly, it's a very conscious
yeah.
kind of act. You have, for the most part, either an individual looking out at the camera, looking out at the viewer or you, mm-hmm. or people together, but in a sense, very conscious of being photographed. Did you pose anybody? Did you let them essentially figure out how they wanted to be in front of a camera?
Yeah, well, I found that the least successful images were the ones that I had posed. But just going back to the first part of your question, they are very formal in their nature. I use a Polaroid camera, and it's a kind of a clunky apparatus, which takes a lot of time to set up. And I decided to make them formal in that I wanted it to be clear that I had their consent and that they were collaborating with me in making the image and looking directly at me, that they weren't sort of surreptitiously taken, unbeknownst to them. And, initially, you know, I would ask them, say, to hold a pose that I thought was very striking, maybe. But I quickly found that the ones that I could imagine as being strong never had the resonance that the ones I recognized afterwards for having been powerful. There's that image of the three women, and that for me was probably the most instructive image I have ever made. It was one of the first days that I was working in the camp, and I should probably describe it a bit.
Yeah.
There was a young girl, 15-year-old girl, who was recovering from malaria. And it was on this, I'd say the second or third day that I was working in the camp. It was late in the afternoon. And I didn't really feel like making the image, but one of Deng Dao's helpers asked me to photograph this family because they were related to him. And I agreed. And in fact, I didn't really think the image was all that strong right after having made it. I guess I was too overwhelmed by the experience. But later, when I looked at it after some time, I saw the way in which this girl, 15, is not, in recovering from malaria, is not sort of standing there on her own. She's bolstered by her pregnant mother and her aunt, and her aunt sort of anchors her from the side and chooses to direct her gaze at her niece. And this is somebody who's never been photographed before, and yet that's her first inclination, is not to see herself rendered, but to show her concern for this daughter for this niece who's recovering.
Well, I think this theme of people touching each other is one that you see over and over mm-hmm. in these photographs. When there are two people or more together, there's a real strong physicality between the people. And I assume this happened naturally.
Yeah, that's a natural thing. And something that I've always marveled at, because it was so absent in a lot of other images I had seen. Of course, I've spent a lot of my life in Kenya, and so I have always been very drawn to the physical, demonstrative nature of the communities there. You know, in Nairobi, men hold hands, and it's not a sexual thing. It's just a kind of a bond, a camaraderie. And this is the way that the people often presented themselves to the camera, to me, and then, you know, by extension to the viewer, was as a unit. And almost all of the camps have found that though people are maybe in desperate circumstance, you rarely have the sense that they're alone.
Mm.
And there's something about that I've not learned before, that though there are these external organizations helping them, they also have the ability to help themselves in the face of, you know, a horrible, horrific history.
Well, looking at your book, you don't use the word camp. You describe these as refugee communities. So
mm-hmm.
there is structure, there is organization, there is relationship going on. Is that something that you think you found because you approached these refugee communities, camps, in a different kind of way than another kind of photographer?
Well, one of the reasons I call them communities is that they are certainly ongoing. And I think a lot of the media imagery is from the initial exodus. I mean, the most current one, say, in regard to my book, was the Rwanda situation, where 250,000 people flooded into Tanzania in the course of a single day. It was the largest exodus in the history of refugee migration. And for my part, I'm more interested in going to those communities after they've reestablished some of their bonds. The Rwandan camps, in general, would recreate the village that they had in Rwanda within the refugee camp. And so that was the way I was most interested in visiting, I think, was to see them when they were beginning to be a unit again, sort of fending for themselves. And there's another thing that that sort of touches on is the way, it's a kind of a Marxist aesthetic, I guess, where you're willing to sacrifice the individual in the image to your higher purpose. And that was something, I guess, that I instantly, I couldn't feel close to that. I didn't feel a kinship with that at all. Somehow I thought if you were going to get to some higher good, it had to be through the specific nature of the individual and his testimony. That there's just the time when you feel as though it's not appropriate to make a picture, or at least I do. And I've always felt uncomfortable trespassing on that line. Mm. And I think that that's probably just a personal thing. I don't mean to say that those other images don't in some way have an effect in the world. I just mean personally what it is to trespass on a very personal moment in, you know, either in illness or in death or, you know, something like that.
And when you have a camera in your hands, you feel this is a powerful instrument that you have in your hands.
It is a powerful instrument. It is. You know, early on, I thought a lot about exploitation. And the truth of the matter is I don't like making the pictures all that much, because what it does is the act sets you apart. And so in a certain sense, that's why I chose to work in this way, because I'm less interested in the act of making that image, but I am interested in the sort of the communal thing that goes around making the image, because it is that, you know, you have to use a tripod and it's a clunky camera. You know, it becomes a real part of the day. It becomes a real event. And that part I quite like.
Well, I'm trying to imagine then, as you took these photographs with your big clunky camera, as you describe it, would people gather around? Was there a crowd behind you watching you work?
Oh, yeah.
And perhaps giving instructions, ideas,
sometimes they would give me instruction, and often they they would stand there and sort of instruct the sitter for the photograph, you know, and how they should hold themselves, or, you know, mockingly. Yeah, I usually had a horde of assistants surrounding me. I mean, some of the images are just couples of people, but, you know, there are generally, you know, 50 or 100 people beside me.
I'm curious, since I imagine a lot of these people have never been photographed before, how you explained to them what you were doing and why?
Well, I generally explained to them that this was, loosely, it was an opportunity for them to present their side of what their lives were like. And, you know, I work with this Polaroid camera, so you get a negative and a picture at the same time. And so people who had never been photographed before often, you know, maybe have never even seen their likeness in a mirror, you show them the picture. And sometimes, like as in the Ethiopian camp, the women would look at the image and they couldn't really recognize it as them.
They didn't see themselves.
No, until somebody would point out, you know, no, that's you. And suddenly they just go, oh, just couldn't
happy,
fathom
you
it.
Think?
Oh,
or
absolutely happy. Sorry, there was an unclear screech. But yeah, so in their presentation, I think, I don't happen to believe that the presentation is so much because of their not having photographed. I think it's more cultural in terms of this is who I am and what I have to offer. Somebody asked me recently, well, they had seen the show and they spoke about, I think maybe they read it into the images, I'm not sure, you'd have to tell me, but that they said that some of the images were of the faces that were sort of fearful and anxious. And I thought, I asked them why that was, and they said, well, look, they never smile. And I thought about that and I thought, well, you know, isn't a Western presentation to the camera so much more fearful and anxious in that we're not willing to look at it and say, you know, here I am, this is my face with all its, you know, nooks and crannies. It's more I have to put on my facade or my game face.
Well, looking at a number of the photographs, I'm reminded of the kinds of portraits portraits taken at the in the 19th century in this country when photography was new. There was a kind of formality. People were unsmiling, but they seemed very honest. I mean, there was an honest, direct look at the camera. And I wonder whether you saw that too.
I do. I think sometimes it may be an intimidating look because it asks you what you're bringing to the image. And certainly with refugees, you have a lot of prior knowledge, I think, about what that life must mean and entail. And certainly I've been drawn to a lot of 19th century work, you know, in early 20th century Walker Evans. And not so much maybe the images, but the sort of dogged determination to follow through on their project, you know, on documenting whatever it was, you know. That impresses me greatly.
We're going to take a very short break and talk some more. My guest is Fazıl Şeyh, and he has a book of photographs called A Sense of Common Ground, and it's photographs taken at various refugee camps in Africa, and an exhibition of his work is at the International Center of Photography in New York City. It will be there through March 31st. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Fazıl Şeyh. When you're at a camp, where do you stay?
It depends on the camp. Sometimes I would sleep just outside. You know, they were generally in the desert, so I would drive from the camp and sleep outside. Often I stay with the High Commission for Refugees or Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders. They generally go to more remote areas and stay closer into the camps. I'm really greatly impressed with what they do. They are people who just, you know, the doctors are also building the hospital. You know, they don't just fly in for an operation and then take off. They really live there and take care of the camp on many different levels.
Are there times when you think, especially looking at the difficult life in a refugee camp, that you'd rather be a doctor than a photographer, that you could do more?
That's a great question. I mean, when I was first working in the camps, I saw things that I felt like I really wanted the tools that a doctor had. I wanted that ability. And for a long time, I actually was planning to go to medical school, oddly enough. And I continued to work in the camps a little bit through this period. And I had some friends who were doctors there, in particular with this Doctors Without Borders. And I found as I would visit with them and talk to them that they had the same sense of, in some respect, futility, that though they had a tangible effect on the people, you know, somebody came in ill, they could fix them, they went home, there was always somebody else. And so what I was drawn to in medicine was the notion that you really had a tangible, something that you could measure your effect. And in making art or documenting in this way, you have to trust that it has some effect in the world, but you can't measure it so readily.
Not so tangible.
No, it's not nearly as tangible. And I have since come to realize that maybe, though I could have been, you know, a doctor, I could have learned that skill, I think, that I feel more comfortable staying with what I think is what I have to say about the place.
Your father's from Kenya. Your mother was from the United States. And when did you first go back to Kenya? When was the first time you ever went there?
Oh, I was 2 and 3 years old. Some of my first memories, actually, are from Kenya.
From Nairobi? Is that where your family's from?
From Nairobi, yeah. My father grew up there, and all of his family is there. It's funny, recently, people have been asking me about that, and as though somehow the fact that my father was Kenyan justifies the endeavor, justifies the work. Well, you know, I sort of feel like it doesn't matter where you come from. You could easily be Kenyan and make a body of images that is sort of alienating. It's a kind of, I don't know if it's a reverse racism or what, that somehow it justifies who I am rather than the images sort of speaking on their own. But certainly I think I'm a product of that mixed background, and the way that I approach my life and the making of the images is from those two very different perspectives.
I mean, yeah, how different are those perspectives? And I'm curious to how much time you go back and forth between those two continents.
Yeah, I used to feel a little bit conflicted in moving back and forth because I could fit into both areas, but somehow they didn't jive with one another, and so I felt that kind of culture shock. My mother was from New Jersey and from sort of a white WASP family from near here. And my father's family, Indian originally, what's now Pakistan, but had emigrated to Nairobi, and his father had lived there since the early part of the century. And so, I mean, these very different families, you know, and also grew up in New York City, in a mm-hmm. place where, you know, it was hard to be a racist or you see yourself as some sort of minority. You know, now I go back to Kenya and they say, oh, but you are 0.5 because, you know, you're half American and half Kenyan. And I'm sure that that has greatly informed the images that I make, in that I don't really see myself as other. You know, I see it as sort of one big community. And so it enables you to go anywhere.
You've certainly traveled a lot. And is a camera a good traveling companion?
No.
No?
Sorry. It helps you it helps me to focus and maybe begin to explore how you fit or how you feel about a place. It's still therapeutic in that way. So in that sense, it is a good companion because it focuses your attention, you know, literally. In another sense, I'm always wary of what ability it has to set you apart. And lately, I'm much more comfortable with that. I'm not interested so much in going into a community and feeling like I fit in. I think that's something I was more concerned about when I was younger, was, well, I have to prove myself to these people because I want to be part. Well, no, I mean, I accept who I am, and I'm grateful for their hospitality, mm-hmm. but I don't so much want to give over my views of the world to them.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Photographer Fazel Sheikh, his book about African refugees is called A Sense of Common Ground. An exhibition of his photographs is on view at the International Center for Photography in New York through the end of March. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Separation anxiety, sibling rivalry, obsessive-compulsive disorder, welcome to the world of dogs. Coming up, we talk with Dr. Nicholas Dodman, an expert on the psychology of canines. When behavioral training doesn't work, Dodman prescribes drugs, even Prozac. And rock historian Ed Ward on Austin, Texas's place in the music scene.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane in for Terry Gross. As the best friends of men and women, dogs live complicated lives. Like humans, they need food and shelter and a loving relationship. And like humans, they can develop behavioral problems because of the environment they live in and because of their lineage. When those behavior problems become unmanageable, dog owners often turn to people like Nicholas Dodman. He's director of the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he's also a professor of behavioral pharmacology. Dodman researches the effects of drugs like Prozac and phenobarbital on aggressiveness, anxiety, and obsessive compulsiveness in dogs. His new book about his work is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. Let's begin with behavior modification. I asked Dodman what theories he applies in his work with canine clients.
Well, one of the fundamental sort of underpinnings of sort of the clinical science of animal behavior modification is the study of ethology, which started years ago with sort of famous ethologists who studied the natural behavior of all sorts of species in the wild, you know, including the dog. And from that work, we learned what dogs would normally do and how they would communicate, you know, and how they signal to each other, and reproductive behavior, you know, what sort of form that takes, and courting behavior and all these sort of things. And from the study of the natural behavior in the wild, you can extrapolate to the sort of the wolf in your living room. But also the science is based on studies in psychology, studies of learning and thoughts of motivation and so on, as well as that. So this is how we can modify the patterns that we see.
I'm curious that if somebody brings a dog to you, let's say this is a dog that chews everything in sight, how do you begin the process of diagnosis?
Well, the people are often a little concerned when they come to us because they, you know, they worry in case, you know, they're going to be psychoanalyzed, or in case we're going to put the dog on a couch and try communicating with it or some such. But it's really quite a matter-of-fact-ish type approach that we have the owner and the dog come into our consulting room, and they sit down and we ask them a series of questions which relate to their dog's, actually every aspect of the dog's life from the moment it was born until the present time, focusing particularly on background things like exercise, diet, level of communication, obedience training, if you like, how obedient the dog is. Also, the specific problem, events which appear to trigger the problem, and how the animal behaves immediately prior to the actual problem, what happens during the event, what happens afterwards, things the owners have tried to modify it, and so on. And the whole thing culminates in a diagnosis, just like in regular veterinary medicine.
Is there something embarrassing about bringing a dog to a behavior therapist?
It appears so. You know, I mean, it seems that women are more open to this than men. I mean, that's the way it appears to me. Quite often, it's a woman that brings the animal in, and she might bring her husband in tow, who sometimes looks a little sheepish and sits quietly until, you know, they understand what we're doing, and that it's a sort of, it's a science that we're practicing. And once it becomes more rational, then they join in, but they're very concerned to start with. At least it would be something more curious.
How much, though, do you look at what the dog's owners do? Look at the way that they treat the dog, the perhaps mixed signals they might give the dog? I'm thinking oftentimes when children are brought into a therapist, a child exhibiting behavior problems, oftentimes that's a signal that there might be something wrong within the family. Do you approach it that way, too?
We do. We do regard the problem that exists as what is termed a dyadic in nature, which means that it involves two components. It involves, you know, oftentimes one person or the family and the dog. So it's kind of an interactive problem. And sometimes the dog's actually doing something entirely normal, but it's not, it's not to the owner's liking. So that becomes a problem, even though the dog is not actually doing anything abnormal for its species. Other times, the dog is doing something abnormal, but the owner's reaction feeds into the problem, making it worse often. That's why we see them, and we try and change that interaction so that the behavior gradually becomes better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about aggression. You say this is the number one behavior problem, and aggression can exhibit itself in many different kinds of ways. But you talk about a Rottweiler named Rocky. What was his problem?
His problem was dominance-related aggression, which is the most common behavior problem that I see, and it's also the most common behavior problem in dogs, according to all of the published work. So it probably comprises about 50% of any behaviorist caseload, and essentially, you know, in a nutshell, is aggression towards family members or literally biting the hand that feeds. It stems from the dog's pack mentality and their natural drive, at least not all dogs, but ones with an inherited dominant drive to move upwards through the pack, pushing all aside ahead of them unless they reach a stopping point, which should be an authoritative human being. And this is where we find that owners can unwittingly contribute to propagating this behavior because they interpret the dog's behavior differently and respond with kindness and a sort of really softness, which actually leads to more of that type of behavior.
And the problem with Rocky was that the wife, there was a husband and wife couple that brought Rocky in. The husband was able to deal with him quite well, but he began to bite the wife. Now, what was he saying? What was the meaning of his behavior?
Well, dominance is relative, like all things are supposed to be these days, and it depends on the relationship of the dog, which is dominant, with each individual that it comes in contact with, whether that's a person or a dog. And in terms of Rocky, as far as his male owner was concerned, this male owner, by his body language and behavior, had managed to transmit to Rocky that he was clearly in charge. And as far as the woman was concerned, who was reacting with sort of kindness and tenderness in situations where perhaps she should have taken a firmer line, she ended up by being the subject of considerable unwanted aggression from Rocky. So it was a complete dichotomy, just total zero aggression to the man, and the woman, really, it was almost a kind of an abusive situation.
So if we're looking at pack behavior, Rocky was working his way up to the top of the pack, and he had to get her out of the way. Is that right?
He just was number two in that pack. So the man was number one, and he was number two, and the woman was number three. So the man could get away with murder, and the poor woman could do nothing. So the job in that case was to try and I could not change her personality, but what I could do is I could change the way that she interacted with Rocky in order to sort of generate some respect from him. It's almost like the old Stanley Dangerfield thing, you know, can't get no respect. So we try and increase their authority by just different ways that they interact. And essentially, it's just taking a firm line. It doesn't mean being unkind. It just means setting limits and following through and doing what you intend to do.
So specifically, what did you have the woman do?
There's a series of steps. At the moment, there are nine. I'm hoping to add one to it to make it the 10 steps. But it starts off with we insist that the people do not confront their dog. If you confront a dominant dog, they're likely to get more aggressive, and you can get into serious trouble. At least the clients we see who arrive at us really as a last resort. And these dogs are usually pretty bad players. And if we have them start to, you know, yank on a collar or force them into a down position or yell at them, they would probably get bitten. So no confrontation is the number one golden rule. And number two, we have them work on obedience. And number three, we have them make the dog work for everything that it wants. So the name of the program is, some people call it Nothing in Life is Free. Some people call it Working for a Living. And another good term is No Free Lunch. So everything that dog wants, whether it's food, praise, toys, exercise, or freedom, it must do something first before it receives those wonderful things from its owner. And the owner does control the resources and can control the dog's behavior in that way. And the program is pretty successful if the owners understand it, follow through.
One of the things you talk about in dealing with dogs with aggressive problems is don't pet indiscriminately. Why not?
Well, that's true. And really the reason is that you will intimidate almost any type of dog. So, for example, if you take a dominant dog like Rocky and you walk up and you pet him on the head, contrary to what most people think, dogs like us don't like to be patted on the head. You know, a far less threatening thing to do is to pet them, you know, between their front legs and their chest. A little gentle scratch there is much more appropriate and appreciated much more. Or to stroke the hair gently, the direction that it grows, you know, on the side of the head. Petting on the head or patting on the head is just not appreciated. A dominant dog has a good chance of growling or biting you. And because that particular gesture of a hand coming down from above over the head is construed as, you know, a dominant or, you know, for a dominant dog, a subordinate gesture by the approaching human, because of the threatening nature of it, a fearful dog will also react, especially if it's in a tight corner, by biting you out of fear. And essentially the message there is they're trying to drive the bogeyman away.
Nicholas Dodman works with dogs with behavior problems at Tufts University. His book is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to dog behaviorist and researcher Nicholas Dodman. When do you decide that you need to intervene medically? And this is something that you're doing research in, and you use what we consider to be psychiatric medications to deal with certain canine behavior problems.
It depends on the condition. You know, if I was dealing with dominance aggression, I would probably try and manage without medicine in the first instance because the programs work reasonably well. Only if the behavior was refractory to treatment, if it was a kind of a low responder, or if I wanted a more broad spectrum effect, would I start suggesting to the owners that they would use behavior modifying drugs. If you talk about conditions in the fear spectrum, most simple fears do respond well to desensitization programs, so we would attempt that first with the appropriate background modification of diet and exercise and communication through obedience training. But with a fearful condition, we wouldn't really hesitate to use very safe and specific medicine to sort of, I call it like the pharmacological shoehorn, just to grease or lubricate the desensitization program. But in the last category of behavior problems, which are the compulsive behaviors, with them, I would probably be recommending that they medicate these dogs right off the bat, even though there is some other serious environmental and behavior modification advice that goes along with that.
What kind of medication do you use then for a dog that has a dominance aggression problem? What drugs do you turn to?
Drugs that work on that famous basic neurotransmitter, neuromodulator, serotonin. Mm-hmm. People throw their arms up in amazement when you mention the name Prozac, but Prozac and the Prozac family, which have a serotonin enhancing effect, we did just show recently in a scientific study, statistically analyzed and otherwise proven, that in fact there is a decrease in dominance aggression when dogs are treated with Prozac, and sometimes I believe that can be a very useful effect, either to complement behavior modification therapy or in some other instances, perhaps even without behavior modification therapy. It depends a lot on the circumstances.
Do you see side effects when using something like Prozac on a dog?
We do. We sometimes see a decrease in appetite, in weeks 2, 3, or 4 of treatment. It's usually transient, but it does have a slight effect of reducing hunger. And we also sometimes see a little bit of what a colleague of mine calls loginess. You know, they become a little bit more lethargic. Not always, but a percentage of them will go that way. And I have heard one or two owners saying they thought their animals actually a little bit more alert and active and perhaps barked a little more, which is the equivalent of humans who get agitated when they're first put onto Prozac. So we sort of see the same spectrum of side effects as you see with Prozac in people.
And does Prozac work in dogs the way it works with people? Work on their brain and central nervous system?
Well, yes. You know, and I think that people somehow imagine that dogs are, you know, tremendously different from people, because they walk on all fours and they're furry all over. But as a matter of fact, you know, their brains are very similar. They have all the same landmarks there. They have a fewer corrugations in their cerebral cortex and perhaps don't rely on that as heavily as we do. Not so cognitively endowed, but essentially it's, just shades of gray. And the cells are the same, and the connections are the same, and the neurotransmitters are the same. So it really comes as no surprise to a biologist to find that a drug like serotonin has exactly the same effects in a dog as it has in people.
Do you want to eventually wean a dog from Prozac? Do you think there's any danger in keeping them on Prozac for their behavior for the rest of their life?
I don't believe there is at this point. I think it's always untrue to say I don't think there's any danger, but mm-hmm. We have had animals, dogs and cats, on Prozac or Prozac-like medication for some years now, and people have been on Prozac for sort of 7 or 9 years or something, and so far there don't seem to be any serious long-term side effects. And so it does seem to be safe in the long term, and it's considerably safer, as I just mentioned, than anything that's gone before. Veterinarians were prescribing acepromazine, which is a phenothiazine tranquilizer with antihistaminic action, and that is essentially a sedative. They were prescribing synthetic progesterone-like substances, which cause considerable depression and organ damage. They were prescribing phenobarbital, which is just a CNS depressant, and it's not specifically dealing with the behavior problem at all. They were prescribing Valium with gay abandon, which is addictive and has some very nasty effects in cats and as well as dogs, as well as increasing appetite and turning them into a couch potato. So there's been some very nasty things that have gone before, but nothing has ever attracted as much attention as Prozac, which is safer and more specific than the rest put together.
Is there any danger in using a human solution, and by that I mean drugs like Prozac for animal problems? If dogs are really being asked to live in a human world, and yes, they've been domesticated, but there still must be some wild genes at work there, is it asking too much of them?
I don't think that, the solution to the behavior problems that dogs exhibit should be, thought of as something which is simply fixed with a pill. I think that it requires a much more broad-spectrum effect. I think it is important for us to get the attention of the AKC and to insist on better breeding, including breeding for temperament and tests for temperament that would encourage people to produce basically better dogs. I think it's important to educate people to know how to socialize and raise puppies so that they don't dig a hole for themselves and end up with behavior problems that subsequently need to be treated. I think it's important to educate people about environmental enrichment so that they realize that a dog is not like a lawn tractor that you park and go away to work and come back and it's just still sitting there waiting for you to turn the key. I think it's important to make sure dogs are fed properly and exercise properly and that they can communicate properly. And you do everything you can do. And if you have a problem, I think it's important to engage whatever behavior modification programs are appropriate, and there are different ones for different occasions, to solve that problem. And somewhere down that line of chain of events, if to turn a dog around permanently, you require to facilitate that by giving, for example, a beta blocker like propranolol to a nervous dog to facilitate desensitization, or if you require to give a dog with compulsive licking a drug like Prozac to stop that compulsive licking and perhaps save it from losing a leg, then I think that's an appropriate adjunct to a behavior modification therapy.
Nicholas Dodman is director of the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he's also a professor of behavioral pharmacology. His book is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with Dr. Dodman, focusing on separation anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorders in dogs. This is Fresh Air. If you want to hear live music, Austin, Texas is the place to go. And this week, the city plays host to the 10th annual South by Southwest Music Festival. 5,000 music industry people are expected to attend, and more than 500 acts are booked. The festival built its reputation on showcasing alternative music, especially unsigned and independent acts. Today we begin a two-part series from rock historian Ed Ward, tracing the history of Austin, Texas as an active music scene.
Ask anybody in the music industry these days, and they'll tell you that Austin, Texas is one of the up-and-coming scenes in America. This is hardly a profound observation. About the only remarkable thing about it is that it took the industry so long to catch on. Austin's really only been active as a music scene for the past 30 years. Texas' first big stars, the Lightcrust Doughboys, were based in Fort Worth, and both Houston and San Antonio eclipsed the capital city for years. But Austin is the home of the University of Texas, and it was there that the current music scene was born. If an exact place can be said to exist, it would have been Kenneth Threadgill's filling station on North Lamar, where the old man, a rabid fan of Jimmy Rogers and an accomplished yodeler, gathered some of Texas' first folkies around him in the early 60s. By the early 70s, a lot of this folk interest had coalesced into a rediscovery of some of Texas' musical traditions, including Western swing, a jazzy, all but forgotten country style that had largely come from Texas. Sleep at the Wheel, a Western swing revival band from Oakland, California, helped spark this interest, and another immigrant, Willie Nelson, moved from Nashville at about the same time. Suddenly, the words Cosmic Cowboy were on all lips.
I said, give me a bottle of NyQuil, that restful sleep my body needs. I said, give me a bottle of NyQuil, that restful sleep my body needs.
what you need. He sent me a roll of duct tape and a case of NyQuil, please. So give me a bottle of NyQuil that restful sleep my body needs. Analgesic decongestant with an antihistamine.
Alvin Crow and the Pleasant Valley Boys were just one of the Austin bands that bent the tradition some during this period. Singer-songwriters appeared to be growing on trees. Steve Fromholtz, Rusty Weir, Jerry Jeff Walker, and dozens of others played clubs like the Split Rail, Soap Creek, and of course, Armadillo World Headquarters, the hippie dance hall where Willie Nelson first drew together the redneck hippie fusion that made the new scene possible.
Well, it's been rough and rocky traveling, but I'm finally standing upright on the ground. And after taking several readings, I'm surprised to find my mind still fairly sound. Well, I thought Nashville was the roughest, but I know I've said the same about them all. Received our education in the cities of the nation, me and Paul. Almost busted and
biding his time, living on the royalties from the country classics he'd penned in the 60s, Willie was omnipresent. The new music was dubbed progressive country thanks to Coke FM, the city's favorite radio station, but Nashville snubbed it. Worse, it had a hard time getting out of Texas. Not only did record companies have no idea what to do with it, but Austin had no music business infrastructure. No recording studios, no music publishers, no management companies. Much of the best of this music vanished into the warm Texas night after it had been played. Eventually, Nashville caught on, and outlaw country became a fad in the early 80s. Willie became a star, and the Austin progressive country scene passed into the hands of the Lubbock Mafia, Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and people like Lucinda Williams, whose approach was just as alien to Nashville as Willie's had seemed a decade earlier. As always, when success beckoned, Austin stayed true to itself and went its own way.
Ed Ward continues his look at the origins of the Austin music scene tomorrow. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Well, you can't go home if you're going by the mill, cause the bridge washed down at the bottom of the hill, and the big creek's up and the little creek's level, gonna plow my corn with a double shovel. Stay all night, stay a little longer, dance all night, dance a little longer, pull off your coat. Throw it in the corner, don't see why, don't stay little long. Well, now you ought to see my blue-eyed Sally. She lives away down on Shinbone Alley, and the number on the gate, number on the door. The next house over is a grocery store. You got to stay all night, stay a little long.